as a response.
"A piece of advice," he said gently. "The Amir are dramatic figures. When we are young, we all pretend to be Amir and fight battles with willow switch swords. It is natural for boys to be attracted to those stories."
He met my eyes.
"However, a man, an arcanist, must focus himself on the present day. He must attend to practical things."
He held my eyes as he continued to speak.
"You are young. Many will judge you by that fact alone."
I drew a breath, but he held up a hand.
"I am not accusing you of engaging in boyish fancy. I am advising you to avoid the appearance of boyish fancy."
He gave me a level look, his face as calm as always. I thought of the way Ambrose had treated me and nodded, feeling color rise to my cheeks. Lauren brought out a pen and drew a series of hashes through my single line of writing in the ledger book.
"I have a great respect for curiosity," he said, "but others do not think as I do. I would not see your first term unnecessarily complicated by such things. I expect things will be difficult enough for you without that additional worry."
I bowed my head, feeling as if I'd somehow disappointed him. "I understand. Thank you, sir." Chapter 39. Enough Rope. The next day I was 10 minutes early to Heme's class, sitting in the front row. I hoped to catch Heme before the class started, thereby saving myself from having to sit through another one of his lectures. Unfortunately, he did not appear early. The lecture hall was full when he entered by the hall's lower door and climbed the 3 steps onto the raised wooden stage. He looked around the hall, eyes searching me out.
"Ah, yes, our young prodigy. Stand up, would you?"
Uncertain as to what was going on, I stood.
"I have pleasant news for everyone," he said. "Mr. Quoth here has assured me as to his complete grasp of the principles of sympathy. In doing so, he has offered to give today's lecture."
He made an expansive gesture for me to join him on the stage. He smiled at me with hard eyes.
"Mr. Quoth?"
He was mocking me, of course, expecting me to slink down into my seat, cowed and ashamed. But I had had enough of bullies in my life, so I climbed onto the stage and shook his hand. Using a good stage voice, I spoke to the students.
"I thank Master Heme for this opportunity. I only hope that I can help him shed some light on this most important subject."
Having started this little game, Heme was unable to stop it without looking foolish. As he shook my hand, he gave me the look a wolf gives a treed cat. Smiling to himself, he left the stage to assume my recently vacated seat in the front row. Confident of my ignorance, he was willing to let the charade continue. I would never have got away with it, if not for 2 of Heme's numerous flaws. First, his general stupidity in not believing what I had told him the day before. Second, his desire to see me embarrassed as thoroughly as possible. Plainly said, he was giving me enough rope to hang myself with. Apparently, he didn't realize that once a noose is tied, it will fit one neck as easily as another. I faced the class.
"Today I will be presenting an example of the laws of sympathy. However, as time is limited, I will need help with the preparations."
I pointed to a student at random.
"Would you be so good as to bring me one of Master Heme's hairs, please?"
Heme offered one up with an exaggerated graciousness. As the student brought it up to me, Heme smiled in genuine amusement, certain that the more grandiose my preparations were, the greater my embarrassment would be in the end. I took advantage of this slight delay to look over what equipment I had to work with. A brazier sat off to one side of the stage, and a quick rifling of the drawers in the work table revealed chalk, a prism, sulphur matches, an enlarging glass, some candles, and a few oddly shaped blocks of metal. I took three of the candles and left the rest. I took Master Heme's hair from the student and recognized him as Basil, the boy Heme had browbeat yesterday. "Thank you, Basil. Would you bring the brazier over here and get it burning as quickly as you can?" As he brought it closer, I was delighted to see that it was equipped with a small bellows. While he poured alcohol onto the coal and struck a spark to it, I addressed the class. "The concepts of sympathy are not entirely easy to grasp, but underneath everything there remain three simple laws. First is the doctrine of correspondence, which says similarity enhances sympathy. Second is the principle of consanguinity, which says a piece of a thing can represent the whole of a thing. Third is the law of conservation, which says energy cannot be destroyed nor created. Correspondence, consanguinity, and conservation, the three C's." I paused and listened to the sound of a 100 pens scratching down my words. Beside me, Basil pumped industriously at the bellows. I realized I could grow to enjoy this. "Don't worry if it doesn't make sense yet. The demonstration should make everything abundantly clear." Looking down, I saw the brazier was warming nicely. I thanked Basil and hung a shallow metal pan above the coals and dropped two of the candles in to melt. I set a third candle in a holder on the table and used one of the sulphur matches in the drawer to set it alight. Next, I moved the pan off the heat and poured its now melted contents carefully onto the table, forming a fist-sized blob of soft wax. I looked back up at the students. "In sympathy, most of what you are doing is redirecting energy. Sympathetic links are how the energy travels." I pulled out the wicking and began kneading the wax into a roughly human-shaped doll. "The first law I mentioned, similarity enhances sympathy, simply means that the more things resemble each other, the stronger the sympathetic link between them will be." I held the crude doll up for the class to inspect. "This," I said, "is Master Heme." Laughter muttered back and forth across the hall. "Actually, this is my sympathetic representation of Master Heme. Would anyone like to take a guess as to why it is not a very good one?" There was a moment of silence. I let it stretch out for a while. A cold audience. Heme had traumatized them yesterday, and they were slow in responding. Finally, from the back of the room, a student said, "It's the wrong size." I nodded and continued to look around the room. "He isn't made of wax either." I nodded. "It does bear some small resemblance to him in general shape and proportion. Nevertheless, it is a very poor sympathetic representation. Because of that, any sympathetic link based off it would be rather weak, perhaps 2% efficiency. How could we improve it?" There was another silence, shorter than the first.
"You could make it bigger,"
someone suggested. I nodded and waited. Other voices called out.
"You could carve Master Heme's face on it. Paint it. Give it a little robe."
Everyone laughed. I held up my hand for quiet and was surprised by how quickly it fell.
"Practicality aside, assume you did all these things. A 6-foot, fully clothed, masterfully carved Master Heme stands beside me," I gestured. "Even with all that effort, the best you might hope for is 10 or 15% sympathetic link. Not very good. Not very good at all. This brings me to the second law, consanguinity. An easy way of thinking of it is once together, always together. Due to Master Heme's generosity, I have one of his hairs." I held it up and ceremoniously stuck it to the head of the doll. "And as easy as this we have a sympathetic link that will work at 30 to 35%.
I had been watching Hemme. While at first he had seemed a little wary, he had lapsed back into a self-satisfied smirk. He knew that without the appropriate binding and properly focused ala, all the wax and hair in the world wouldn't do one whit of good. Sure that he had taken me for a fool, I gestured to the candle and asked him,
"With your permission, master?"
He made a magnanimous wave of compliance and settled back into his chair, folding his arms in front of him, confident in his safety. Of course, I did know the binding. I told him so, and Ben had taught me about the Allah, the riding crop belief, back when I was 12. But I didn't bother with either. I put the doll's foot into the candle flame, which guttered and smoked. There was a tense, held-breath quiet as everyone stretched in their seats to get a look at Master Hemme. Hemme shrugged, feigning astonishment. But his eyes had the look of a jaw trap about to close. A smirk tugged at one corner of his mouth, and he began to rise from his seat.
"I feel nothing? What?"
"Exactly," I said, cracking my voice like a whip, startling the students' attentions back to me.
"And why is that?"
I looked expectantly at the lecture hall.
"Because of the third law that I had mentioned. Conservation. Energy cannot be destroyed or created, merely lost or found. If I were to hold a candle underneath our esteemed teacher's foot, very little would occur. And since only about 30% of the heat is getting through, we do not even get that small result."
I paused to let them think for a moment.
"This is the prime problem in sympathy. Where do we get the energy? Here, however, the answer is simple."
I blew out the candle and relit it from the brazier, muttering the few necessary words underneath my breath.
"By adding a second sympathetic link between the candle and a more substantial fire..."
I broke my mind into two pieces, one binding Hemme and the doll together, the other connecting the candle and the brazier.
"We get the desired effect."
I casually moved the foot of the wax doll into the space about an inch above the candle's wick, which is actually the hottest part of the flame. There was a startled exclamation from where Hemme was sitting. Without looking in his direction, I continued speaking to the class in the driest of tones.
"And it appears that this time we are successful."
The class laughed. I blew out the candle.
"This is also a good example of the power that a clever sympathist commands. Imagine what would happen if I were to throw this doll into the fire itself."
I held it over the brazier. As if on cue, Hemme stormed onto the stage. It may have been my imagination, but it seemed to me that he was favouring his left leg slightly.
"It appears that Master Hemme wishes to resume your instruction at this point."
Laughter rippled through the room, louder this time.
"I thank you all, students and friends, and thus my humble lecture ends."
At this point, I used one of the tricks of the stage. There is a certain inflection of voice and body language that signals a crowd to applaud. I cannot explain how exactly it is done, but it had its intended effect. I nodded my head to them and turned to face Hemme amidst applause which, though far from deafening, was probably more than any he had ever received. As he took the last few steps towards me, I almost backed away. His face was a fearsome red, and a vein pulsed at his temple as if it were about to explode. For my own part, my stage training helped me maintain my composure. I returned his gaze levelly and held out my hand for him to shake. It was with no small amount of satisfaction that I watched him give a quick glance to the still applauding class, swallow, and shake my hand. His handshake was painfully tight. It might have become worse if I hadn't made a slight gesture over the brazier with the wax doll. His face went from its livid red to an ashen white more quickly than I would have believed possible. His grip underwent a similar transformation, and I regained my hand. with another nod toward the seated students, I left the lecture hall without a backward glance. Chapter 40 On the Horns. After Hemme dismissed his class, news of what I had done spread through the university like wildfire. I guessed from the students' reactions that Master Hemme was not particularly well-loved. As I sat on a stone bench outside the mews, passing students smiled in my direction. Others waved or gave laughing thumbs up. While I enjoyed the notoriety, a cold anxiety was slowly growing in my gut. I'd made an enemy of one of the nine masters. I needed to know how much trouble I was in. Dinner in the mess was brown bread with butter, stew, and beans. Manet was there, his wild hair making him look like a great white wolf. Simon and Sauvoy groused idly about the food, making grim speculations as to what manner of meat was in the stew. To me, less than a span away from the streets of Tarbin, it was a marvellous meal indeed. Nevertheless, I was rapidly losing my appetite in the face of what I was hearing from my friends.
"Don't get me wrong," Sauvoy said. "You've got a great weighty pair on you. I'll never call that into question, but still," he gestured with his spoon, "they're going to string you up for this."
"If he's lucky," Simon said. "I mean, we are talking about malfeasance here, aren't we?"
"It's not a big deal," I said with more assurance than I felt. "I gave him a little bit of a hot foot, that's all."
"Any harmful sympathy falls under malfeasance," Manet pointed at me with his piece of bread, his wild, grizzled eyebrows arching seriously over his nose. "You've got to pick your battles, boy. Keep your head down around the masters. They can make your life a real hell once you get into their bad books."
"He started it,"
I said sullenly through a mouthful of beans. A young boy jogged up to the table, breathless.
"Your Quoth,"
he asked, looking me over. I nodded, my stomach suddenly turning over.
"They want you in the master's hall."
"Where is it?" I asked. "I've only been here a couple of days."
"Can one of you show him?"
the boy asked, looking around at the table.
"I've got to go and tell Jameson I found him."
"I'll do it,"
Simon said, pushing away his bowl.
"I'm not hungry anyway."
Jameson's runner boy took off, and Simon started to get to his feet.
"Hold on," I said, pointing to my tray with my spoon. "I'm not finished here."
Simon's expression was anxious.
"I can't believe you're eating," he said. "I can't eat. How can you eat?"
"I'm hungry," I said.
"I don't know what's waiting in the master's hall, but I'm guessing I'd rather have a full stomach for it."
"You're going on the horns," Manet said. "It's the only reason they'd call you there at this time of night."
I didn't know what he meant by that, but I didn't want to advertise my ignorance to everyone in the room.
"They can wait until I'm done."
I took another bite of stew. Simon returned to his seat and poked idly at his food. Truth be told, I wasn't really hungry anymore, but it galled me to be pulled away from a meal after all the times I'd been hungry in Tarbin. When Simon and I finally got to our feet, the normal clamour in the mess quieted as folk watched us leave. They knew where I was headed. Outside, Simon put his hands in his pockets and headed roughly in the direction of Hollows.
"All kidding aside, you're in a good bit of trouble, you know.
I was hoping Hemme would be embarrassed and keep quiet about it," I admitted. "Do they expel many students?"
I tried to make it sound like a joke.
"There hasn't been anyone this term," Sim said with his shy, blue-eyed smile. "But it's only the second day of classes. You might get some sort of record."
"This isn't funny," I said, but found myself wearing a grin regardless. Simon could always make me smile, no matter what was going on. Sim led the way, and we reached Hollows far too soon for my liking. Simon raised a hand in a hesitant farewell as I opened the door and made my way inside. I was met by Jameson. He oversaw everything that wasn't under direct control of the masters, the kitchens, the laundry, the stables, the stockrooms. He was nervous and bird-like, a man with the body of a sparrow and the eyes of a hawk. Jameson escorted me into a large windowless room with a familiar crescent-shaped table. The Chancellor sat at the centre, as he had during admissions. The only real difference was that this table was not elevated, and the seated masters were close to eye level with me. The eyes I met were not friendly. Jameson escorted me to the front of the crescent table. Seeing it from this angle made me understand the references to being on the horns. Jameson retreated to a smaller table of his own, dipping a pen. The Chancellor steepled his fingers and spoke without preamble.
On the 4th of Caitlin, Heme called the masters together.
Jameson's pen scratched across a piece of paper, occasionally dipping back into the inkwell at the top of the desk. The Chancellor continued formally.
Are all the masters present?
Master Physicker?
Said Arwill.
Master Archivist?
Said Lauren, his face impassive as ever.
Master Arithmetician?
Brandia said, cracking his knuckles absently.
Master Artificer,
grumbled Kilvin, without looking up from the tabletop.
Master Alchemist,
said Mandrag.
Master Rhetorician.
Hemi's face was fierce and red.
Master Sympathist,
said Elxadal.
Master Namer.
Elodin actually smiled at me. Not just a perfunctory curling of the lips, but a warm, toothy grin. I drew a bit of a shaky breath, relieved that at least one person present didn't seem eager to hang me up by my thumbs.
And Master Linguist,
said the Chancellor.
All eight,
he frowned.
Sorry, strike that, all nine masters are present. Present your grievance, Master Heme.
Heme did not hesitate.
Today, first-term student Quoth, not of the Arcanum, did perform sympathetic bindings on me with malicious intent.
Two grievances are recorded against Quoth by Master Heme,
the Chancellor said sternly, not taking his eyes away from me.
First grievance, unauthorized use of sympathy. What is the proper discipline for this, Master Archivist?
For unauthorized use of sympathy, leading to injury, the offending student will be bound and whipped a number of times, not less than 2 nor more than 10, singly across the back,
Lauren said as if reading off directions for a recipe.
Number of lashes sought?
The Chancellor looked at Heme. Heme paused to consider.
5.
I felt the blood drain from my face, and I forced myself to take a slow, deep breath through my nose to calm myself.
Does any master object to this?
The Chancellor looked around the table, but all mouths were silent. All eyes were stern.
The second grievance, malfeasance, Master Archivist.
4 to 15 single lashes and expulsion from the university,
Lauren said in a level voice.
Lashes sought.
Heme stared directly at me.
8.
13 lashes and expulsion. A cold sweat swept over me, and I felt nausea in the pit of my stomach. I had known fear before. In Tarbin it was never far away. Fear kept you alive. But I had never before felt such a desperate helplessness. A fear not just for my body being hurt, but for my entire life being ruined. I began to get lightheaded.
Do you understand these grievances set against you?
The Chancellor asked sternly. I took a deep breath.
Not exactly, sir.
I hated the way my voice sounded, tremulous and weak. The Chancellor held up a hand and Jameson lifted his pen from the paper.
It is against the laws of the university for a student who is not a member of the Arcanum to use sympathy without permission from a master.
His expression darkened.
And it is always, always, expressly forbidden to cause harm with sympathy, especially to a master. A few hundred years ago, Arcanists were hunted down and burned for things of that sort. We do not tolerate that sort of behavior here.
I heard a hard edge creep into the Chancellor's voice. Only then did I sense how truly angry he was. He took a deep breath.
Now do you understand?
I nodded shakily. He made another motion to Jameson, who set his pen back to the paper.
Do you, Quoth, understand these grievances set against you?
Yes, sir,
I said as steadily as I could. Everything seemed too bright, and my legs were trembling slightly. I tried to force them to be still, but it only seemed to make them shake all the more.
Do you have anything to say in your defense?
The Chancellor asked curtly. I just wanted to leave. I felt the stares of the masters bearing down on me. My hands were wet and cold. I probably would have shaken my head and slunk from the room had the Chancellor not spoken again.
Well?
The Chancellor repeated testily.
No defense?
The words struck a chord in me. They were the same words that Ben had used 100 times as he drilled me endlessly in argument. His words came back, admonishing me.
What? No defense? Any student of mine must be able to defend his ideas against an attack. No matter how you spend your life, your wish will defend you more often than a sword. Keep it sharp.
I took another deep breath, closed my eyes, and concentrated. After a long moment, I felt the cool impassivity of the heart of stone surround me. My trembling stopped. I opened my eyes and heard my own voice say,
I had permission for my use of sympathy, sir.
The Chancellor gave me a long, hard look before saying,
What?
I held the heart of stone around me like a calming mantle.
I had permission from Master Heme, both express and implied.
The masters stirred in their seats, puzzled. The Chancellor looked far from pleased.
Explain yourself.
I approached Master Heme after his first lecture and told him I was already familiar with the concepts he had discussed. He told me we would discuss it the next day. When he arrived for class the next day, he announced that I would be giving the lecture in order to demonstrate the principles of sympathy. After observing what materials were available, I gave the class the first demonstration my master gave me.
Not true, of course. As I've already mentioned, my first lesson involved a handful of iron drabs. It was a lie, but a plausible lie. Judging by the master's expressions, this was news to them. Somewhere deep in the heart of stone, I relaxed, glad that the master's irritation was based on Heme's angrily abridged version of the truth.
You gave a demonstration before the class?
The Chancellor asked before I could continue. He glanced at Heme, then back to me. I played innocent.
Just a simple one, is that unusual?
It is a little odd,
he said, looking at Heme. I could sense his anger again, but this time it didn't seem to be directed at me.
I thought it might be the way you proved your knowledge of the material and moved to a more advanced class,
I said innocently. Another lie, but again plausible. Elk-Sadal spoke up.
What did the demonstration involve?
A wax doll, a hair from Heme's head, and a candle. I would have picked a different example, but my materials were limited. I thought that might be another part of the test, making do with what you were given.
I shrugged again.
I couldn't think of any other way to demonstrate all three laws with the materials on hand.
The Chancellor looked at Heme.
Is what the boy says true?
Heme opened his mouth as if he would deny it. Then apparently remembered that an entire classroom full of students had witnessed the exchange. He said nothing.
Damn it, Heme,
Elk-Sadal burst out.
You let the boy make a simulacra of you, then bring him here on malfeasance,
he spluttered. You deserve worse than you got.
Eller Quoth could not have hurt him with just a candle,
Kelvin muttered. He gave his fingers a puzzled look as if he were working something out in his head.
Not with hair and wax. Maybe blood and clay.
Order!
The Chancellor's voice was too quiet to be called a shout. but it carried the same authority. He shot looks at Elxadal and Kilvin.
Quoth, answer Master Kilvin's question.
I made a second binding between the candle and a brazier to illustrate the law of conservation.
Kilvin didn't look up from his hands.
Waxen hair?
He grumbled as if not entirely satisfied with my explanation. I gave a half-puzzled, half-embarrassed look and said,
I don't understand it myself, sir. I should have got a 10% transference at best. It shouldn't have been enough to blister Master Hemme, let alone burn him.
I turned to Hemme.
I really didn't mean any harm, sir,
I said in my best distraught voice.
It was just supposed to be a bit of a hot foot to make you jump. The fire hadn't been going more than 5 minutes, and I didn't imagine that a fresh fire at 10% could hurt you.
I even wrung my hands a little, every bit the distraught student. It was a good performance. My father would have been proud.
Well, it did, Hemme said bitterly. And where is the damn mommet anyway? I demand you return it at once.
I'm afraid I can't, sir. I destroyed it. It was too dangerous to leave lying around.
Hemme gave me a shrewd look.
It's of no real concern, he muttered.
The Chancellor took up the reins again.
This changes things considerably. Hemme, do you still set grievance against Quoth?
Hemme glared and said nothing.
I move to strike both grievances,
Arwill said, the Physicker's old voice coming as a bit of a surprise.
If Hemme set him in front of the class, he gave permission. And it isn't malfeasance. If you give him your hair and watch him stick it on the mommet's head.
I expected him to have more control over what he was doing,
Hemme said, shooting a venomous look at me.
It's not malfeasance,
Arwill said doggedly, glaring at Hemme from behind his spectacles, the grandfatherly lines on his face forming a fierce scowl.
It would fall under reckless use of sympathy,
Lauren interjected coolly.
Is that a motion to strike the previous two grievances and replace them with reckless use of sympathy?
Asked the Chancellor, trying to regain a semblance of formality.
Aye,
said Arwill, still glaring fearsomely at Hemme through his spectacles.
All for the motion,
the Chancellor said. There was a chorus of ayes from everyone but Hemme.
Against?
Hemme remained silent.
Master Archivist, what is the discipline for reckless use of sympathy?
If one is injured by reckless use of sympathy, the offending student will be whipped singly no more than 7 times across the back.
I wondered what book Master Lauren was reciting from.
Number of lashes sought?
Hemme looked at the other masters' faces, realizing the tide had turned against him.
My foot is blistered halfway to my knee, he gritted. 3 lashes.
The Chancellor cleared his throat.
Does any master oppose this action?
Aye,
Elxadal and Kilvin said together.
Who wishes to suspend the discipline? Vote by show of hands.
Elxadal, Kilvin, and Arwill raised their hands at once, followed by the Chancellor. Mandrag kept his hand down, as did Lauren, Brandyr, and Hemme. Elodine grinned at me cheerily, but did not raise his hand. I kicked myself for my recent trip to the archives and the bad impression it made on Lauren. If not for that, he might have tipped things in my favor.
4.5 in favor of suspending punishment,
the Chancellor said after a pause.
The discipline stands. 3 lashes to be served tomorrow, the 5th of Caitlin, at noon.
As I was deep into the heart of stone, all I felt was a slight analytical curiosity about what it would be like to be publicly whipped. All the masters showed signs of preparing to stand and leave, but before things could be called to a close, I spoke up. Chancellor? He took a deep breath and let it out in a gush.
Yes.
During my admission, you said that my admittance to the Arcanum was granted contingent upon proof that I had mastered the basic principles of sympathy.
I quoted him nearly word for word.
Does this constitute proof? Both Heme and the Chancellor opened their mouths to say something. Heme was louder.
Look here, you little cocker!
Heme!
The Chancellor snapped. Then he turned to me.
I'm afraid proof of mastery requires more than a simple sympathetic binding.
A double binding,
Kilvin corrected gruffly. Elodine spoke, seeming to startle everyone at the table.
I can think of students currently enrolled in the Arcanum who would be hard-pressed to complete a double binding, let alone draw enough heat to blister a man's foot to the knee.
I'd forgotten how Elodine's light voice moved through the deep places in your chest when he spoke. He smiled happily at me again. There was a moment of quiet reflection.
True enough,
admitted Elxadal, giving me a close look. The Chancellor looked down at the empty table for a minute, then he shrugged, looked up, and gave a surprisingly jaunty smile.
All in favor of admitting first-term student Quoth's reckless use of sympathy as proof of mastery of the basic principles of sympathy, vote by show of hands.
Kilvin and Elxadal raised their hands together. Arwill added his a moment later. Elodin waved. After a pause, the Chancellor raised his hand as well, saying,
5.5 in favor of Quoth's admission to the Arcanum. Motion passed, meeting dismissed, Taelu shelter us, fools and children all.
He said the last very softly, as he rested his forehead against the heel of his hand. Heme stormed out of the room with Brandir in tow. Once they were through the door, I heard Brandir ask,
Weren't you wearing a gram?
No, I wasn't, Heme snapped. And don't take that tone with me as if this were my fault. You might as well blame someone stabbed in an alley for not wearing armor.
We should all take precautions,
Brandir said placatingly.
You know as well as...
Their voices were cut off with the sound of a door closing.
Kilvin stood and shrugged his shoulders, stretching. Looking over to where I stood, he scratched his bushy beard with both hands, a thoughtful look on his face, then strode over to where I stood.
You have your segaldre yet, Elir Quoth?
I looked at him blankly. Do you mean runes, sir? I'm afraid not. Kilvin ran his hands through his beard thoughtfully.
Do not bother with the basic artificing class you have signed for. Instead, you will come to my workroom tomorrow, noon.
I'm afraid I have another appointment at noon, Master Kilvin.
Yes,
he frowned.
First bell, then.
I'm afraid the boy will be having an appointment with my folk shortly after the whipping, Kilvin,
Arwill said, with a glimmer of amusement in his eyes.
Have someone bring you to the Medicar afterwards, son. We'll stitch you back together.
Thank you, sir. Arwill nodded and made his way out of the room. Kilvin watched him go, then turned to look at me.
My workshop, day after tomorrow, noon.
The tone of his voice implied that it wasn't really a question. I would be honored, Master Kilvin. He grunted in response and left with Elxadar. That left me alone with the still-seated Chancellor. We stared at each other while the sound of footsteps faded in the hallway. I brought myself back up out of the heart of stone and felt a tangle of anticipation and fear at everything that had just happened. I'm sorry to be so much trouble so soon, sir, I offered hesitantly.
Oh?
He said, his expression considerably less stern now that we were alone.
How long had you intended to wait?
At least a span, sir. My brush with disaster had left me feeling giddy with relief. I felt an irrepressible grin bubble onto my face.
At least a span,
he muttered. The Chancellor put his face into his hands and rubbed, then looked up and surprised me with a wry smile. I realized he wasn't particularly old when his face wasn't locked in a stern expression. Probably only on the far side of 40.
You don't look like someone who knows he's going to be whipped tomorrow,
he observed. I pushed the thought aside. I imagine I'll heal, sir. He gave me an odd look. It took me a while to recognize it as the one I'd grown accustomed to in the troop. He opened his mouth to speak, but I jumped on the words before he could say them. I'm not as young as I look, sir, I know it. I just wish other people knew it, too.
I imagine they will before too long.
He gave me a long look before pushing himself up from the table. He held out a hand.
Welcome to the Arcanum.
I shook his hand solemnly, and we parted ways. I worked my way outside and was surprised to see that it was full night. I breathed in a lungful of sweet spring air and felt my grin resurface. Then someone touched me on the shoulder. I jumped fully 2 feet into the air and narrowly avoided falling on Simon in the howling, scratching, biting blur that had been my only method of defense in Tarbin. He took a step back, startled by the expression on my face. I tried to slow my pounding heart.
Simon, I'm sorry, I'm just... Try to make a little noise around me, I startle easily.
Me too,
he murmured shakily, wiping a hand across his forehead.
I can't really blame you, though. Riding the horns will do that to the best of us. How did things go?
I'm to be whipped and admitted to the Arcanum. He looked at me curiously, trying to see if I was making a joke.
I'm sorry, congratulations?
He made a shy smile at me.
Do I buy you a bandage? Or a beer?
I smiled back.
Both.
By the time I got back to the fourth floor of the Mews, rumour of my non-expulsion and admission into the Arcanum had spread ahead of me. I was greeted by a smattering of applause from my bunkmates. Heme was not well loved. Some of my bunkmates offered awed congratulations, while Basil made a special point of coming forward to shake my hand. I had just climbed up to a sitting position on my bunk and was explaining to Basil the difference between a single whip and a six-tail when the third-floor steward came looking for me. He instructed me to pack up my things, explaining that Arcanum students were located in the West Wing. Everything I owned still fit neatly into my travel sack, so it was no great chore. As the steward led me away, there was a chorus of goodbyes from my fellow first-term students. The West Wing bunks were similar to those I had left behind. It was still rows of narrow beds, but here they weren't stacked too high. Each bed had a small wardrobe and desk in addition to a trunk, nothing fancy, but definitely a step up. The biggest difference was in the attitudes of my bunkmates. There were scowls and glares, though for the most part I was pointedly ignored. It was a chilly reception, especially in light of the welcome I had just received from my non-Arcanum bunkmates. It was easy to understand why. Most students attend the university for several terms before being admitted into the Arcanum. Everyone here had worked their way up through the ranks the hard way. I hadn't. Only about 3/4 of the bunks were full. I picked one in the back corner, away from the others. I hung my one extra shirt and my cloak in the wardrobe and put my travel sack in the trunk at the foot of my bed. I lay down and stared at the ceiling. My bunk lay outside the light of the other students' candles and sympathy lamps. I was finally a member of the Arcanum. In some ways, exactly where I had always wanted to be. Chapter 41 Friend's Blood. The next morning, I woke early, washed up, and grabbed a bite to eat at the mess. Then, because I had nothing to do before my whipping at noon, I strolled the university aimlessly. I wandered through a few apothecaries and bottle shops, admired the well-kept lawns and gardens. Eventually, I came to rest on a stone bench in a wide courtyard. Too anxious to think of doing anything productive, I simply sat and enjoyed the weather, watching the wind tumble a few scraps of waste paper along the cobblestones. It wasn't too long before Willem strolled over and sat himself next to me without an invitation. His characteristic Kildish dark hair and eyes made him seem older than Simon and me, but he still had the slightly awkward look of a boy who wasn't quite used to being man-sized yet.
"Nervous?" he asked with the harsh burr a Siaru accent makes.
"Trying not to think about it, actually," I said.
Willem grunted. We were both quiet for a minute while we watched the students walk past. A few of them paused in their conversations to point at me.
I quickly grew tired of their attention. Are you doing anything right now?
Sitting, he said simply.
Breathing?
Clever. I can see why you're in the Arcanum. Are you busy for the next hour or so?
He shrugged and looked at me expectantly.
Would you show me where Master Arwill is? He told me to stop by after.
Certainly, he said, pointing to one of the courtyard's outlets.
Medicar is on the other side of Archives.
We made our way around the massive windowless block that was the Archives. Willem pointed.
That is Medicar.
It was a large, oddly shaped building. It looked like a taller, less rambling version of Mainz.
Bigger than I thought it would be, I mused. All for teaching medicine?
He shook his head.
They do much business in tending the sick. They never turn anyone away because they can't pay.
Really? I looked at Medicar again, thinking of Master Arwill.
That's surprising.
You need not pay in advance, he clarified.
After you recover,
he paused, and I heard the clear implication, if you recover,
you settle accounts. If you have no hard coin, you work until your debt is...
He paused.
What is the word for shame?
He asked, holding out his hands with the palms up and moving them up and down as if they were the pans of a scale.
Wade?
I suggested. He shook his head.
No, shame!
He stressed the word and brought his hands even with each other.
Oh,
I mimicked the gesture.
Balanced.
He nodded.
You work until your debt is balanced with the Medica. Few leave without settling their debts.
I gave a grim chuckle.
No, that's surprising. What's the point of running away from an Arcanist who has a couple of drops of your blood?
We eventually came to another courtyard. In the center of it was a pennant pole with a stone bench underneath it. I didn't need to guess who was going to be tied to it in an hour or so. There were about 100 students milling around, giving things an oddly festive air.
It's not usually this big, Willem said apologetically, but a few masters cancelled classes.
Heme, I'm guessing, and Brandia.
Willem nodded.
Heme, halls, grudges.
He paused to give emphasis to his understatement.
He'll be there with his whole coterie.
He pronounced the last word slowly.
Is that the right word? Coterie?
I nodded, and Willem looked vaguely self-satisfied. Then he frowned.
That makes me remember something strange in your language. People are always asking me about the road to Tinui. Endlessly they say, how is the road to Tinui? What does it mean?
I smiled. It's an idiomatic piece of the language. That means...
I know what an idiom is,
Willem interrupted.
What does this one mean?
Oh, I said, slightly embarrassed. It's just a greeting. It's kind of like asking, how is your day, or how is everything going?
That is also an idiom,
Willem grumbled.
Your language is thick with nonsense. I wonder how any of yous understand each other. How is everything going? Going where?
He shook his head.
Tinue, apparently, I grinned at him.
Twan volgan o kethama,
I said, using one of my favourite Siaru idioms. It meant, don't let it make you crazy, but it translated literally as, don't put a spoon in your eye over it. We turned away from the courtyard and walked around the university aimlessly for a while. Willem pointed out a few more notable buildings, including several good taverns, the alchemy complex, the Kaeldish laundry, and both the sanctioned and unsanctioned brothels. We strolled past the featureless stone walls of the archives, past a cooper, a bookbinder, an apothecary. A thought occurred to me. Do you know much herb lore? He shook his head.
Chemistry, mostly, and a dabble in the archives with puppet sometimes.
Dabble, I said, emphasizing the b sound for him. Dapple is something else. Who's puppet? Will paused.
Hard to describe.
He waved a hand to dismiss the question.
I'll introduce you later. What do you need to know about herbs?
Nothing, really. Could you do me a favour? He nodded and I pointed to the nearby apothecary.
Go buy me 2 scruples of gnarl root.
I held up 2 iron drams. This should cover it.
Why me?
He asked warily.
Because I don't want the fellow in there giving me the "you're awfully young" look.
I frowned.
I don't want to have to deal with that today.
I was nearly dancing with anxiety by the time Willem got back.
He was busy,
he explained, seeing the impatient expression on my face. He handed me a small paper packet and a loose jingle of change.
What is it?
It's to settle my stomach, I said. Breakfast isn't sitting too well, and I don't fancy throwing up halfway through being whipped. I bought a cider at a nearby pub, using mine to wash down the gnarl root, trying not to grimace at the bitter, chalky taste. Before too long, we heard the belling tower striking noon.
I think I must go to class.
Will tried to mention it nonchalantly, but it came out almost strangled. He looked up at me embarrassed, and a little pale under his dark complexion.
I am not fond of blood,
he gave a shaky smile.
My blood, friend's blood.
I don't plan on doing much bleeding, I said. But don't worry, you got me through the hard part, the waiting. Thank you.
We parted ways, and I fought down a wave of guilt. After knowing me less than 3 days, Will had gone out of his way to help me. He could have taken the easy route and resented my quick admittance into the Arcanum as many others did. Instead, he had done a friend's duty, helping me pass a difficult time, and I had repaid him with lies. As I walked toward the pennant pole, I felt the weight of the crowd's eyes on me. How many were there? 200? 3? After a certain point is reached, the numbers cease to matter, and all that remains is the faceless mass of a crowd. My stage training held me firm under their stares. I walked steadily towards the pennant pole amid a sea of susurrous murmurings. I didn't carry myself proudly, as I knew that might turn them against me. I was not repentant, either. I carried myself well, as my father had taught me, with neither fear nor regret on my face. As I walked, I felt the gnarl root begin to take firm hold of me. I felt perfectly awake while everything around me grew almost painfully bright. Time seemed to slow as I approached the center of the courtyard. As my feet came down on the cobblestones, I watched the small puffs of dust they raised. I felt a breath of wind catch the hem of my cloak and curl underneath to cool the sweat between my shoulder blades. It seemed for a second that, should I wish to, I could count the faces in the crowd around me like flowers in a field. I spotted none of the masters in the crowd, except for Hemi. He stood near the pennant pole, looking pig-like in his smugness. He folded his arms in front of himself, letting the sleeves of his black master's robe hang loosely at his sides. He caught my eye, and his mouth quirked up into a soft smirk that I knew was meant for me. I resolved that I would bite out my own tongue before I gave him the satisfaction of appearing frightened or even concerned. Instead, I gave him a wide, confident smile, then looked away as if he didn't concern me in the least. Then I was at the pennant pole. I heard someone reading something, but the words were just a vague buzzing to me as I removed my cloak and lay it across the back of a stone bench that sat at the base of the pole. Then I began to unbutton my shirt, as casually as if I were preparing to take a bath. A hand on my wrist stopped me. The man that had read the announcement gave me a smile that tried to be comforting.
You don't need to go shirtless, he said. It'll save you from a bit of the sting.
I'm not going to ruin a perfectly good shirt, I said.
He gave me an odd look, then shrugged and ran a length of rope through an iron ring above our heads.
I'll need your hands.
I gave him a flat look.
You don't need to worry about my running off.
It's to keep you from falling over if you pass out.
I gave him a hard look.
If I pass out, you may do whatever you wish, I said firmly. Until then, I will not be tied.
Something in my voice gave him pause. He didn't offer me any argument as I climbed onto the stone bench beneath the pole and stretched to reach the iron ring. I gripped it firmly with both hands, smooth and cool, I found it oddly comforting. I focused on it as I lowered myself into the heart of stone. I heard people moving away from the base of the pole. Then the crowd quieted, and there was no sound but the soft hiss and crack of the whip being loosened behind me. I was relieved I was to be whipped with a single-headed whip. In Tarbin I had seen the terrible bloody hash a six-tail can make of a man's back. There was a sudden hush. Then, before I could brace myself, there came a sharper crack than the ones before. I felt a line of dim red fire traced down my back. I gritted my teeth. But it wasn't as bad as I thought it would be, even with the precautions I had taken. I expected a sharper, fiercer pain. Then the second lash came. Its crack was louder, and I heard it through my body rather than with my ears. I felt an odd looseness across my back. I held my breath, knowing I was torn and bleeding. Everything went red for a moment, and I leaned against the rough, tarred wood of the pennant pole. The third lash came before I was ready for it. It licked up to my left shoulder, then tore nearly all the way down to my left hip. I grit my teeth, refusing to make a sound. I kept my eyes open and watched the world grow black around the edges for a moment before snapping back into sharp, bright focus. Then, ignoring the burning across my back, I set my feet on the bench and loosened my clenched fingers from the iron ring. A young man jumped forward as if he expected to have to catch me. I gave him a scathing look and he backed away. I gathered my shirt and cloak, laid them carefully over one arm, and left the courtyard, ignoring the silent crowd around me.
Chapter 42 Bloodless.
It could be worse, that much is certain.
Master Arwild's round face was serious as he circled me.
I was hoping you would simply wilt, but I should have known better with your skin.
I sat on the edge of a long table deep inside the medica. Arwild prodded my back gently as he chattered on.
But as I say, it could be worse. Two cuts, and as cuts go, you couldn't have done better. Clean, shallow, and straight. If you do as I tell you, you'll have nothing but smooth silver scars to show the ladies how brave you are.
He stopped in front of me and raised his white eyebrows enthusiastically behind the round rings of his spectacles.
Eh?
His expression wrung a smile from me. He turned to the young man that stood by the door.
Go and fetch the next relar on the list. Tell them only that they are to bring what is needful to repair a straight, shallow laceration.
The boy turned and left, his feet pattering away in the distance.
You will provide excellent practice for one of my relar,
Arwill said cheerfully.
Your cut is a good straight one, with little chance of complication, but there's not much to you.
He prodded my chest with a wrinkled finger, and made a noise with his tongue against his teeth.
Just bones and a little wrapping. It is easier for us if we have more meat to work with. But,
he shrugged, bringing his shoulders almost to his ears, and back down.
Things are not always ideal. That is what a young physicker must learn more than anything.
He looked up at me as if expecting a response. I nodded seriously. It seemed to satisfy him, and his squinting smile returned. He turned and opened a cabinet that stood against one of the walls.
Give me just a moment and I will numb the burning that must be all across your back.
He clinked a few bottles together as he rummaged around on its shelves. It's all right, Master Arwill, I said stoically. You can stitch me closed the way I am. I had two scruples of Nelroot numbing me, and I knew better than to mix anesthetics if I could avoid it. He paused with one arm deep into the cabinet and had to withdraw it to turn and look at me.
Have you ever had stitches before, my boy?
Yes, I said honestly.
Without anything to soften the pain?
I nodded again. As I sat on the table, my eyes were slightly higher than his. He looked up at me skeptically.
Let me see, then,
he said, as if he didn't quite believe me. I pulled my pant leg up over my knee, gritting my teeth as the motion tugged on my back. Eventually, I revealed a handspan worth of scar on my outer thigh, above my knee, from when Pike had stabbed me with his bottle glass knife back in Tarbin. Arwill looked at it closely, holding his glasses with one hand. He gave it one gentle prod with his index finger before straightening.
Sloppy,
he pronounced with a mild distaste. I had thought it was rather a good job. My